we are very used to an assumption that our actions create our results. We know that. What we do is going to determine and define our results. What we don't realize to a great degree is that our thinking is what creates those actions. So our thoughts are what create the actions. So really, our thoughts are what are creating those results. Well, the systems are all rooted in thought. They're all rooted in a thought framework, our assumptions, our beliefs, our thinking. And what became very clear very early on in our own thinking was, just as I said earlier, that systems are the answers to questions. Well, thinking is the answers to questions. All of our thoughts, all of our assumptions, all of our beliefs, they're answers to questions we don't even realize we're asking.
Hello, and you're very welcome to another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast with me, Shane Breslin. This is episode number 35, and my guest on this episode is Hilde Gottlieb. Hilde Gottlieb is a social scientist and the founder of an organization called Creating the Future. Creating the Future is focused on helping people and organizations to change the systems they find themselves in, to aim those systems at bringing out the best in people, all by changing the questions they ask. The movement is a multi-year experiment to answer the question, if people everywhere were asking the kinds of questions that bring out the best in themselves and those around them, how much more humane could the world be? During this wide-ranging conversation, Hilde and I chat about creating the future's catalytic thinking framework based on research on what makes positive change happen and what specifically is not happening when so many people are struggling to create positive change. We chat about the mission of Creating the Future to experiment with catalytic thinking and to share the lessons learned so that anybody around the world can create change. We talk about the trend towards profit for purpose, conscious capitalism, and other ideas around business for good. We talk about the disconnect between the stock market and the world that the vast majority of people live in. We chat about how big systems, which can cause a convoluted mass of problems in so many ways for so many people, might, in time, with the right questions, be challenged and changed. Hilde talks about the concept of collective enoughness and why competition has in many ways created the unsustainability that the world is grappling to deal with now. We talk about all that and lots more. I do hope you enjoy this conversation with the co-founder of Creating the Future, Hilde Gottlieb. Hilde, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Shane. It's wonderful to be with you.
So I want to hear all about Creating the Future, but before I go there, I'd like to hear about the past and how that came about.
It is impossible, actually, to describe Creating the Future without describing the path that led to it. And I will make the many lives I've led that have become intertwined, I will make that as brief as possible so that we can focus on the present and the future. But I think it is important for all of us to acknowledge the past that has led to our present. I came out of school with a political science and economics degree. I wanted to change the world and thought that I was going to run for office. I worked for an elected official and quickly realized that elected officials don't change the world. There's an old adage from the 60s that if the people will lead, the leaders will follow. And I very quickly learned that working for an elected official, that's not where change happens. From there, did several different stints as varied as business ownership, commercial real estate, just at the very, very far end of that spectrum, of that commercial spectrum. And in 1993, my business partner, my then business partner and now husband, and I were working at a commercial real estate firm that we wound up buying and realized very quickly that we didn't like what we were doing. My background was in political organizing and his background was in labor organizing. And here we are doing commercial real estate because both of us sort of wound up there and very unhappily. And so we made a list that we jokingly at the time called the Mary Poppins list. And I don't know if you recall, if you've got small children, anybody that's got small children and has seen the original Mary Poppins, those children went through nanny after nanny after nanny. And finally, they wrote down everything they really wanted. She must play games. She must be smart. And someone ripped it up and tore it up. It went up the chimney and here comes Mary Poppins. And so we decided we would ask for what we wanted out of life, send it up the chimney and see what happened. And the list sort of included, we wanted life to be something we could bring our families. At the time, we were not together. Dimitri was still married. Bring our families along, have our kids enjoy. We wanted to learn and grow. We wanted to be able to be creative. But the bottom line for us was at the end of the day, we wanted the world to be a better place. And what we said was very much like Mary Poppins, we will go, and whatever comes in the door that sort of feels like that, sounds like that, that's where we'll go. We wound up doing a lot of consulting. We wound up consulting to not only community organizations, but to Native American tribes, doing economic development work, sustainable economic development work, strength-based, place-based. In the U.S., gambling, casinos is a big part of what tribes use to generate income, and we worked with tribes that weren't doing that. And some of the most fulfilling work I've ever done, and we can talk about that in a separate podcast if you like, but also wound up doing a lot of work with community organizations and suddenly had the epiphany about 5 years into that work that we had changed our entire lives to change the world and nothing seemed like it was changing. No matter what we did strategic planning and board work and all of the things that consultants to community organizations do. We were doing it the way everybody else did it and we were supposedly very good at it. We were, you know, the old marketing thing that if you don't have to market and you're just by word of mouth, you're doing something right. That was us. And how could we be doing so well and people thought it was great and nothing was changing? And what we realize now we did, this was way back, this was 20 something years ago. What we realized we started doing was changing the questions we were asking. And we started, you know, hindsight being a wonderful tool, realizing that what we did at the time was to sort of deconstruct. We had been doing business turnaround before we got into this work. Said, okay, if this were a business and we were seeing what was wrong, what questions would we ask? And what we found was that at the heart of the work that community organizations of all kind, whether they are social enterprises, whether they are traditional not-for-profits, the heart of that work is answering questions, and the questions we were asking were actually counterproductive. And fast forward 20 years, having developed frameworks around what we found was working, we would change a question here and we go, oh, that's getting a very different answer. And started to find that, again, we were still consulting. The clients we were working with, they were starting to create change both internally, how they thought about things, the questions they asked, and that was starting to ripple out into their communities. And so we wanted to bottle that and put a framework around it. And, you know, 20 years later, that's sort of the work that Creating the Future is doing. Our focus at Creating the Future, bringing it to the present, is really systems change. Because what we realized is that the systems we all operate under, and that could be system. We see systems as just the way we do things. You know, legal systems, this is just the way we do it. Personal systems, workplace systems. What we realized is all of those systems are really answers to questions we don't even realize we're asking. And the questions might be, how do we control people? Or how do we get people to do, you know, whatever those questions are, if we can change the questions at the root of the systems, then the systems change, hopefully to be bringing out the best in what it is to be human, because there's some pretty cool things about what it is to be human. So that's Creating the Future's work, and that's my long and winding story.
No, it's great. Thank you for sharing that. In terms of the reality of what Creating the Future looks like, so it's not, as far as I know from looking in from the outside, it's not just a traditional consultancy or offering advice or advisory basis. What, tell us a little bit about the kind of the mission and the bigger impact that, that Creating the Future is in attempting to bring about?
Absolutely, absolutely. First of all, we formed as a not-for-profit in the U.S., and we did that intentionally. We said that it's very easy to sit from the outside and point fingers and say, this is what you all should do. It is very different to live it, experience it, experiment with it ourselves, see what it feels like. One of the parts of my story that I left out is I've also founded two not-for-profits here in the U.S., diaper banks, very much like food banks, giving out diapers, nappies, because none of the safety nets in the U.S. and many places around the world cover nappies, because in the days they created the safety nets, they were cloth, moms were staying home, and we've sort of rippled that out. And so the experience of knowing what it's like to actually do the work from the inside, we chose to be a not-for-profit. And the mission really is to experiment with this framework we've developed called catalytic thinking. And catalytic thinking grew out of all of the questions we found that worked to create change. And what we did was we both studied what has created change over time. We've all seen change happen in our lifetimes. We have seen a South African freedom movement. We have seen a marriage equality movement. We've seen so much change happen in our lifetimes. What is happening when change happens? That's not happening when so many people are struggling to create that change. And if we could repeat what works, we could create a framework that anybody could use and create that change. And that's really what catalytic thinking is. It is looking at when we started to change the questions we were asking and we started to see change happen. We started to track that with movements, successful movements for social change, and realized the questions we were finding that worked were the same questions that were working in the civil rights movement, in the Indian independence movement. And so to make that repeatable, we created a framework that we call catalytic thinking. Creating the Future's mission is twofold. One is to experiment with catalytic thinking in a lot of different ways, apply it, demonstrate, see what works, see how it works. And we've been doing that for about 10 years. And then the second part of the mission is to share what we learn from that so that anybody can create change. And the thing that we're finding and have found in that first phase of proof of concept, of demonstration, is that asking the questions that catalytic thinking draws us to ask consistently brings out the best in people and consistently creates results that we want to see. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
No, it does. And there's lots of things that I'd love to delve a little bit deeper in. And I want to come back to the questions piece. But first of all, the not-for-profit decision and direction. I've worked in a couple of nonprofits in Ireland in the past number of years. And it feels like there was, you know, traditionally there was the, you know, public sector, business, nonprofit. There were clearly defined buckets of organizations that's what they did. It seems now that that's changing, or there's a much more blurring of the lines between kind of what might be traditionally seen as for-profit business and not-for-profit and social enterprise. And I've seen conscious capitalism and purpose for profit and things like that. What is your kind of sense of that organizations coming together and doing things in a way that maybe it's profit, maybe it's driven by profit, maybe it's not, maybe, but in general, it seems that more businesses and more organizations are trying to do things in a way that is better for more people. Is that fair to say?
I think so. I think there is a heightened consciousness and a demand by the public that the issues of the world have been in large part caused by that separation of we think a business is separate from the environment that they're in. We think that humans are separate from each other. This ridiculous notion of going it alone and separateness has so contributed. And I think that there's a general awareness of that. And so I think that what we're seeing is a natural outgrowth, which is a very nice thing, to seeing people sort of raised to their own higher potential of, oh, our business could be not only working for us, but also working for the community that we live in or working for. And one of the interesting things, Shane, is that small businesses have always done that. So if you think about small business owners have always wanted to, they're raising their kids in the community. They want the schools to be good. They want their kids to be safe. And so small businesses have always done that. What we're starting to see now is a heightened awareness on the part of larger businesses. And in some cases, it's lip service. And in some cases, it's not. And, you know, however, all of that said, it does come down to their success is going to be rooted in why they're doing it. And again, in the questions that they're asking that are guiding that. And you know, that goes hand in hand with the why.
One of the interesting things that I noticed over the last year was the, I think it's the business roundtable in the US, where it's, I don't know, is it like 100 or 500 of the biggest businesses in the world? And I think I'm right in saying that they redefined their stakeholders as much broader than what it had been in the past. That in the past, they were beholden to shareholders above and beyond everybody else. And if the shareholders didn't get the dividend, well, then there was hell to pay. And it seems that while, yeah, the proof of the pudding will be in the eating in a lot of ways, but it seems like the trend is in the right direction. And what's your sense in terms of this voice that we all have now, and we're not sure what to do with it in terms of social media and the loudspeaker that we have, and that anything on any given day can go viral, for want of a better phrase. It seems like that has maybe helped or fast-tracked this shift in focus or this heightened awareness on behalf of maybe big corporates in terms of what their actual footprint is?
I have lived long enough through enough cycles to say that I will believe it when I see it. It is very easy to commit on paper to, yes, we are going to do good. When we see bottom line redefined, then we'll know. You know, I look at the stock market in the U.S. and I'm not paying a lot of attention to the global stock market. I barely pay attention in the U.S. But it is ridiculous that during a global pandemic with the degree of economic uncertainty globally, we watched in the first couple of months of this, the entire world shut down. Entire world shut down. That's never happened before in the history of, at least that we know of, in the history of the world. And the stock market is at all-time highs. That doesn't bode well for we care about people. We're making a lot of money over those people. Oh, okay, then maybe that's a disconnect. So I think, unfortunately, I'll believe it when I see it. But, and I'm going to come back to systems, the systems are set up for that. There's a meme we're all seeing on social media that the systems haven't failed. The systems are doing exactly what they were intended to do. And so until there is significant systemic change, the systems are set up for that.
Let's talk about that briefly, because from my perspective, it feels like the world is so complex and there's so many interlocking systems and so many competing, you know, desires and actions and activities across, on behalf of whatever, the billion people, but also the world itself and nature, that I can't make sense of the systems. And I just wonder, how do you define systems? If you look at, you know, big systems or big problems that might be caused at a systemic level, how do you even set about the task of defining that system before you can even start to try to make some improvements to it?
It is really hard to see stuff when you're in the middle of it. So, you know, picture being in a crowded city and you're lost and you have to get someplace and every street looks like every other street. You stand on the top of a skyscraper, you can look down and go, oh, okay, I need to turn here and I need to turn there and I need to turn there. And so in large part, it really is getting above it and outside it to look at what's really going on. A big part of what we found in designing catalytic thinking, and it really was that first 10 years of playing around with different questions when we were still consulting, was really eye-opening for us, because we're so used to humans are doing machines. I mean, we do. If we're not doing, we don't feel like we're being productive. If you're just sitting around thinking, and we put just in front of that, I'm just sitting around thinking, we don't think that's important. You know, okay, great. You've been thinking. What did you do? And I wish we were visual, because I could show you a graphic, but people can picture this very easily. We are very used to an assumption that our actions create our results. We know that what we do is going to determine and define our results. What we don't realize to a great degree is that our thinking is what creates those actions. So our thoughts are what create the actions. So really, our thoughts are what are creating those results. Well, the systems are all rooted in thought. They're all rooted in a thought framework, our assumptions, our beliefs, our thinking. And what became very clear very early on in our own thinking was, just as I said earlier, that systems are the answers to questions. Well, thinking is the answers to questions. All of our thoughts, all of our assumptions, all of our beliefs, they're answers to questions we don't even realize we're asking. So a very simple example. I assume the world is flat, or I assume the world is round. The real question is, what's going to happen if I go out there? Am I going to fall off? Am I going to continue? And so if we can look at the questions at the heart of these systems, and the people who maintain the system start asking different questions, we will change the thinking that guides those systems, which will change the actions and change the results. We see it in, looking at, for instance, the legal system, criminal justice system. Think about those words, criminal justice. Okay, we assume there's a criminal. We're not assuming this is somebody who is a decent human being in bad circumstances who had to do something for whatever reason. Okay, that's a very different assumption. I wouldn't necessarily call that a criminal justice system. I might call that a mutual responsibility system. I mean, there's a whole, so once we start to, and you're seeing it in the global push for restorative justice, for treating humans like humans, treating humans like they are bundles full of potential, like we are not the things we share with animals, which animals steal, animals, I shouldn't say share with animals, share with the rest of the animal kingdom. Mm-hmm. Remembering that we are animals. And as animals, the way our brains work, animals steal from each other. Animals, if they could verbalize, they lie, but they hide things. They sneak. All of those things that when we say, oh, that's just human nature, it's actually everything that we share with the rest of the animal world. The things that make us uniquely human, our systems are set up for all of those bad things. Those systems are not set up to bring out all of the good in us. Humans are able to envision a world that doesn't currently exist. And as sweet as my dog is, she can't do that. Humans are able to envision that we are part of a planet with 7 billion people. And I've not met those 7 billion people, but I'm pretty sure they're there. There's so much that we are capable of. And while the rest of the animal kingdom can do some of those things, we've got the whole bundle. We can do all of it. But the systems that we have set up are set up for the other. They're not set up to bring out that in us. Every time, and I'll continue with the criminal justice system, every time people experiment with systems that actually bring out the best in people, when they happen to have been caught doing something when they were at their worst, those systems consistently work to rehabilitate, bring them back, to make them the whole human that they were when they started before whatever it was intervened. And so looking at systems, both global systems and personal systems, we can change the way we do things in our own homes. And look at the systems we create at home. We call them habits. But you know, think about it. Get up in the morning, I brush my teeth, I make my coffee. Those are systems. If I were to change that, what would happen? If I were to change the conversation I have with my kid every single day, That's a system, a pattern I've gotten into. And again, if it's aimed at what will bring out the best in that other person rather than, they're going to screw up, so we might as well create a system that either prevents them from screwing up or deals with what we're going to do once they do. And so it's really looking at systems from the personal to the global and having the people who run those systems ask different questions.
And what would you say to people, and there are a lot of people, and sometimes it can be very hard to find evidence that they're wrong. It can be very hard to dispute them, who might put forward beliefs in conspiracy theories or that the Illuminati run the world or that everything is set up for the 1% or the 1/10 of 1% against the rest. Is that a valid view, or what are your own kind of thoughts on that arm of thinking that finds a lot of resonance in the online world when we look out there?
The first is that individuals tend to go where systems lead them. The way our brains work, and a lot of what I wound up doing after seeing the success that we were seeing with catalytic thinking, the question becomes very clear, why is it so consistent? And it really comes down to a combination of sciences, primarily brain science, because that's where so much starts in our own heads. We humans crave predictability. We're seeing this in the pandemic like crazy. We crave predictability. It's why people want to go back to normal, even though they're saying, I didn't really like it when we were back there, but we want to go back to normal. It's why people don't buck systems, because the draw of that predictability, we will stay with systems we know aren't working. I mean, look at workplace systems. We will stay with systems we know aren't working, blame the system, grumble about it, because bucking systems really takes a lot of intestinal fortitude, because again, we really crave that predictability. And so a big piece of what we are seeing is that the systems are so set up, focused on what's wrong, and focused on reactivity, and focused on mistrust, focused on scarcity, that it is not a surprise that people in their immense potential for creativity are going to come up with stuff. So for me, looking at, again, the other thought that was going through my mind in terms of, you know, quote, what does it take to change the world? Is go where the water's warm. Go where folks are already, you know, bathing in that water. And are there always going to be folks who are going to be subject to that fear part of our brains that go, everything is messed up? You know, and how many days are each of us doing that? You know, even without a pandemic, there's times where all of us are. Responding to that part of the brain that goes, I can't get out of bed today. But the reality that every system we encounter is set up for that. Human resources is neither about what it means to be human nor really a resource. Human resources is all about, we know you're going to mess up, so here's the rules. And here's three strikes and you're out. And here's the process if you believe that you've been wronged. I mean, think about the words that we encounter. And that's just at work. So if that's what we're encountering all the time, and that's the message we're hearing, and that's what the news is talking about, and this is the water, the wonderful David Foster Wallace, the water we swim in. The story of the fish in the water and the bigger fish coming along and saying, how's the water? And the little fish saying, what's water? Mm-hmm. The water we're swimming in is this mire of systems from start to end, of what's wrong, of reacting to problems, reacting to the worst in each other, suspecting the worst in each other, and then, no surprise, finding the worst in each other. So you know, that's going to breed cells of people who are thinking, oh boy, it really is wrong, and here's proof.
Yeah, absolutely. In order to change the system, whatever the system is, or whoever has some, I won't say in control of the system, because controls is an ephemeral thing, but whoever has influence over the system needs to want to change it or improve it to affect that change. How do you go about it then? What is this the framework or the set of steps that helps to affect that change?
Two answers. The first is to be very, very clear that anybody can change the systems they find themselves in. We talk about it as leading from the middle. You do not need positional authority to change the systems you find yourself in, because if the systems are rooted in questions, anybody can ask a different question.
Okay.
So starting with that, there's really three sets of questions that we focus on, and lots of ripples of those questions, lots of different perturbations of those. The first set of questions is around where we're aiming, and it could be aiming in our personal lives. It could be aiming globally. We are very used to asking the question, what is the problem and how will we solve it? Instead of asking, what is the future that we would like to create and what will it take to create that? What does good look like? We're so used to focused on what bad looks like, and we're going to fix bad. But if instead we're asking questions like, okay, we're in a staff meeting and somebody is grumbling for 20 minutes about how X isn't working, to just be able to say, I get that, and you're probably right, X is not working. What would good look like? What would it look like if it were working? What would it take to aim for that? What our brains do when we focus on what isn't working is we go down that rabbit hole and we all pile on all the stuff that's not working, and we get our thinking actually gets smaller and more granular and more doing. So we get right from, this is what's wrong, how will we fix it, whose fault is it, and we dig into that. Anybody can change that question to say, okay, you're right, it's not working. What would good look like? And it changes the conversation. You can feel, people start to breathe, you could feel shoulders relax. The second set of questions is around the people who are affected by that thing, whatever it is. It could be your family, it could be the world. And the questions that we're very used to asking are all around suspecting the worst in each other. So, okay, I have an idea. Who's going to steal it? How do I protect it? How can I know I can trust you? You know, all of those things. Mm. The flip side of that is, who else cares about this thing I care about? And what could we accomplish together? And it, again, shifts. And these assumptions we have about each other, that we can't trust each other. I'm going to guess that your listeners are very much like every audience I've ever spoken to in every keynote I've ever done. I ask folks to raise their hand if they've ever spent an entire day looking for somebody because they found their wallet. And, you know, half the audience will raise their hand. And then I say, now, if you lost your wallet, what's the first thought? Oh, I better cancel my credit cards because they're going to steal all my money and they're going to... It's, I mean, we have this assumption in our heads about how horrible other people are. I'm obviously the exception because I found a wallet and brought it back to somebody. But I look out in an audience and everybody's hand is raised. We've all done it. And so again, asking those questions, okay, if I stop seeing and think about the systems that we're in that lead people to compete, we are taught marketing. We are taught to differentiate each other. Okay, so in a for-profit business, that may make sense. In a nonprofit, social enterprise, global change setting, to compete with each other is self-defeating because none of us can accomplish it on our own. But to ask that question, instead of who else cares about this and how can I beat them out, who else cares about this and what could we accomplish together? And then the third set of questions, and again, those are questions anybody can ask. Mm-hmm. Well, what if we reached out to the XYZ organization? You know, they're doing the same work. It'd be curious to see how they're doing it. Let's have coffee. You know, what you're risking is a couple of bucks on coffee. Mm. And then the third set of questions is all around resources. So the first is around where we're aiming. The second is around how we feel about each other. And the third is around resources. And the scarcity that drives every single system in the world. I mean, seriously, capitalism is about scarcity. Everything, you know, if we're going to have global peace, will I get more peace than you will? I mean, everything is around this assumption of scarcity. And at Creating the Future, we have coined the phrase collective enoughness, that together we have everything we need, that it's really only on our own that we experience scarcity, and that when we're feeling scarcity, the more we can reach out to others. I frequently find in my personal practice, my personal spiritual practice, that the answer to scarcity is often gratitude. If I can list everybody to whom I'm grateful, I no longer feel scarcity. And I know they care about the same things I care about. And so what do we have together? The people question is, what can we accomplish together? But what do we have together? What could we share? And we're so used to, as individuals, as businesses, as social enterprises, as nonprofits, we are so used to thinking, well, I had an idea. I need to protect that idea. That idea frequently is reacting to a problem rather than creating what is possible. I need to figure out a budget for that idea, and then I need to go find funding for that idea. And that's me, 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 and you're a threat. And I mean, so mm-hmm. Think about all of those systems. And so again, those are all questions anybody can ask. Something simple like, well, in order to do that program, we would need a van. We're only going to use it 2 hours a day when kids are out of school, but we need to go buy a van. Okay, different question, the collective enoughness sharing question. Who else out there has a van that might not be using it those 2 hours? Oh, okay, so maybe a senior center is using it in the morning and we could use it in the afternoon. Again, those different questions are something that anybody can ask, and it changes the conversation and it changes the direction and things shift.
Those three of the people, purpose, resources piece that I read, I think it was in the Stanford Review. I underlined passages in each of those sections, but under resources, the phrase collective enoughness just jumped off the screen to me. It had an emotional resonance that was kind of very, very reaching into my heart. That was not rational or not kind of led by our cold and clinical brains. It felt to me like potentially the largest barrier to cross. And it reminded me of, I think it was Hobbes, one of the philosophers from, 1600s, 1700s, that he talked about one of the big challenges or the natural state of the world in some ways was the war of all against all, where individuals are all pitted against each other. And in a dystopian view of the world as it is now, with us all working, withdrawn in, are forced to withdraw in many ways, and we're working from our home offices, and we're projecting versions of ourselves, however well-intentioned we might be, on social media and various different platforms, that it feels, it feels like we're not too many jumps away from the war of all against all. But the idea of the complete opposite of that, of collective enoughness, really does resonate. What is your experience when you bring that to people? Is there resistance, or do people get that and run with it straight away?
They love it. They love it. And again, in the going where the water's warm, people who think it's hogwash, they don't listen and they go away, and that's fine. And that's fine. Studies have consistently shown that it doesn't take 51% to create a tipping point. It takes 10%, maybe 20%. I'm good with that. It resonates so deeply with people. And right now during the pandemic is such a wonderful example of that, because people aren't going to the store as much, and they are realizing what they can share, and they're coming back to their neighborhoods. The one thing that this time has made so clear to us, in all the horror, and there's so much horror. It's not just the death, but it's a horrible, horrible way to die, and a horrible way to be with the people that you love and can't. I mean, there's horror. The things that we're also seeing is people being there for each other. Early on, I was speaking with a colleague of mine in Australia, and he was saying, you know, in the pre-pandemic days, you were very used to seeing somebody you know and asking, how are you going? And the answer was fine. How are you going? And that was fine. And you went your separate ways. He said, now people are asking and they want to know. Families are getting together on Zoom. People are getting together on, personally, I have a group of women I've known for several decades, and 4 or 5 times a year we get together for drinks, and it is delightful. We have gotten together every single week on Zoom since this started to be there for each other. And so we see that capacity with each other. All of the philosophers throughout the modern age have been steeped in systems we created a long time ago. We didn't create these systems yesterday. These systems are in so many ways what we have seen throughout time. We created them at a time when, go back the 50,000 years. Think about what life was like back then. Yes, people coordinated because they had to. But they also knew that if the neighboring tribe had something and they didn't, that they had to steal it from each other. You did have to mistrust outsiders. You did have to primarily be reactive, because half the time we didn't understand what the world was bringing us. And the other half of the time, it was scary. We did not know how to deal with things. Well, you fast forward, the way we humans evolved and are still around today, we're not faster than other animals. We don't have sharper teeth. We're not stronger. We tell stories and we hand down wisdom. So what's the wisdom we handed down? You can't trust other people. You certainly can't trust other tribes. Trust your tribe, but don't trust other tribes. Resources are scarce, because they were. I mean, so think about the story we've handed down over how many thousands of generations. We've created, and so then we create religions around that, we create philosophies around that, and that becomes the truth. And it is always interesting what we do to people who speak different truths. We cast them aside. We say, oh, that's cute, that's visionary, but we need to do the real thing. Or at the other end, we assassinate them. I mean, you know, Jesus spoke differently. Jesus spoke about what we are talking about right now. Martin Luther King spoke about what we are talking about right now. We don't want to hear it, but that truth is still there. And so we can, again, all of these philosophies come out of studying one way of thinking about the world. And we see it in religion like crazy. We see it in religion, to focus on what's possible, to focus on brother and sister, to focus on the heart of what we have potential to be. And yet we hear that for an hour in church on Sunday, and then we go back to all the systems that are not rooted in that.
Totally. And the idea of collective enoughness, it stirs something in me that I'm kind of, I want to see how we can, how do we get this to the world? Because that's what, when you mention religion, it's something I've been even thinking about, because I'm from Ireland. I grew up 98% of people in Ireland grew up as Roman Catholic. Even in the past 2 weeks, I started thinking about a prayer that we recited every single day when we were in primary school, as, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old. And it was the Confiteor, which means I confess. And the words of it is a confession for us not being enough, for our grievous faults. you know, that we were born like not enough. And that is incredibly shaping in how we see ourselves and see the world. And when I asked the question about it, like, it feels like the largest barrier to cross. It still feels like that to me, but it feels like the payoff, however and whenever we get there, could be astronomical.
Yeah. And when we raise children with all of those old assumptions, they are not enough. Yeah. Because they are, if you're told something over and over and over and over and over again, you believe it, especially as a child. And, you know, Roman Catholicism does not have the corner on that. There's an awful lot of both secular and religious teaching that teaches us from an early age we're not enough.
Yes. And it brings to mind like the what I remember a friend of mine, a theory of the world or a worldview was about the idea of the sickness or being sick and all the vast array of illnesses and conditions, psychological and physical, that have grown up and are treatable over the past 50 to 100 years. And many of them are very, very real and very, very physical. And the treatment has been amazing and the advances in medicine have been amazing. Many of them, in a weird way, are stories, I feel, and are invented to some degree. And we have the worldview that my friend put to me was around that if you are well, if you are really healthy, not many people can make a lot of money off you. And if you are dead, nobody's making any money off you. But if you are sick, and if you're maybe sick for a year, for 5 years, for 10 years, for the rest of your life, you are a cash cow. And it seems like there are many, many people who through no fault of their own, through the systems or the patterns that rule their culture and their lives, have found themselves in that. Sick middle ground where they are almost an industry without knowing it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and the way our brains function, very, very, very quick and very rudimentary look at the brain. If we were to look at the brain as two parts of the brain, there's the reactive part of the brain and then there's the thinking part of the brain. Some of what goes on in the reactive part of the brain, which is really brilliantly designed over millions of years, thousands of years. This is millions of years because brains started in, I think, worms a very long time ago, again, so that we could survive. And in humans, we know that reactive part triggers adrenaline, gets us out of there. We can't control it. It reacts. It also releases a chemical that fewer are familiar with, which is cortisol, because we don't feel cortisol. We feel the adrenaline, our heart pumps. Cortisol's job is to slow down all of the functions that we don't generally control, that are automatic, that don't have to do with getting out of there. So adrenaline gets us out of danger. And cortisol, so we don't have to be digesting our lunch. It stops your digestion. We don't have to be fighting off disease. I got to get out of there. There's a tiger coming. And you ever wonder why it's always a tiger? We'll go someplace else. But at any rate, so cortisol stops all of these sort of unnecessary functions that you don't need to immediately escape danger. One of the things that cortisol stops because you don't need it to get out of there is access to the frontal lobe. It actually puts up a chemical barrier so you can't think straight. And again, I don't need to be thinking, do I like tigers? Are they cute? Are they pretty? I don't like it. No, I need to go. I need to get out of there. And so I don't need to argue with you about different ways. We just need to go. We just need to go. And so people who are advertising anything, and that includes political candidates, they know that. They know that if you are in fear, you are not thinking, you are reacting. So if I tell you that you are never going to find anybody who loves you because you're not using the right deodorant, I'm triggered. If I tell you that unless you can hold a tissue up to your teeth, they're not white enough, then, you know, and I'll just keep inventing stuff just like you said. That is all of the things that make us worry because our brains are triggered for that. And while the other piece of that is that's not our normal state. We have to be triggered. And so we have to be triggered over and over and over and over again for that to become our normal state. And eventually it becomes the brain habit and it becomes our normal state. But it's not our normal state.
Yeah, no, I think I there's so much to that. And I think that the development of marketing psychology, as you touched on there, is one of the most damaging things that has developed over the last probably 50 years, maybe 60 years. This constant tidal wave of subliminal messages telling us that we're not good enough, that we are not enough without booking this holiday or buying this vacuum cleaner or this brand of deodorant or toothpaste.
Or this politician.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Because that's, you know, at the heart of, certainly in the massively ugly political situation in the U.S., fear is at the heart of all of it.
Yeah.
Vote for that person and we're all going to die. And your life will be a living hell. I mean, ugh.
And how does love, because I wouldn't be hesitant to describe what you're putting forward there as loving. How does love conquer fear?
It just does. I mean, period. It just does.
When we allow it.
Yeah. And again, we're conditioned. We're conditioned as humans, we're triggered, but our systems condition us to react to what we are afraid of in ways that we have for thousands of years. But every single time, love conquers fear. And sometimes we need to experience that. Sometimes we need to feel it. We need to see it. We can see it in others and say, oh yeah, but that's because they're them. And again, that's because the systems lead us to that. I know I keep coming back and banging on that same drum, but our systems are so rooted in that it's, and that's the water we swim in. We swim in the water that says, if somebody attacks you, you have got to fight back. And yeah, but you know, you said it, if you take the how out of that and just love does conquer fear.
Hmm. I'm very grateful for your time, Hildy. I have a couple more questions bringing it back to the framework and the creating the future catalytic thinking. The right question. So the framework is about asking the right question or asking a different question, which creates a different thought, which creates a different action, which creates a different outcome or result. How, going right back to the kernel of that, how do you know when you're asking the right question?
First of all, it's not necessarily a right question. It is a more productive question.
Okay.
So, you know, right and wrong, it's not right or wrong. It is an effective question, a productive question. Usually, a productive question feels better. I mean, if nothing else, when we went back to ask why does catalytic consistently create these results, and we found that it's rooted in brain science, what we found is that the questions we are used to asking trigger that reactive part of our brains. How, you know, how can we defeat the competition? There's only so much money, how can we get it? We know what that feels like, and it feels like crap. When we ask questions of who else cares about this and what could we accomplish together, people go, oh, you know, if we were working together, we could, and you could feel energy changes. And it is, what we realized is that catalytic thinking keeps the questions in catalytic thinking keep that reactive brain from firing. So it directly speaks to the frontal lobe. It directly speaks to our capacity for creativity and wisdom and compassion. And if we can keep the other questions trigger our reactivity, and the more productive questions, that reactivity just never fires. And if it does fire, we can start to ask questions like, well, okay, I understand that that's wrong and I'm feeling it. I'm feeling the discomfort. If that wasn't a problem anymore, what would be possible? And you can just feel. And so the way we know generally is you can feel the energy. Within creating the future, somebody will, if we get into, you know, it's easy to get into the weeds. It's easy to get into the, somebody will always say, you know what, we need to raise the question higher. Internally, that's how we talk about it. We need to raise the question higher. And the minute somebody says, okay, so yeah, we get that that's going on. What does it make possible? And we go, oh, okay. And you can just feel the energy shift.
I love that. And it brings me to the next question, which is about between where we are and if we're trying to change some system or create some change, some positive change, irrespective of whether it's a personal or this organizational or government or whatever it might be, between where we are and the grand vision, or if you're like me, and I've always struggled with kind of visualizing anything. So it's like, it's usually vague or fluffy at best in terms of where I want to go. But between where we are and that point, there's a messy middle, and that we can get where reality happens and we can get tripped up on all the details. How can we best navigate that messy middle?
You know, early on, you and I were talking about the difference between being lost in a city and not being able to see the forest for the trees, and then getting up in a skyscraper and seeing, oh, that's where we are. The big picture, interestingly, and if your listeners want to hear it, I did a TEDx talk on this that they can look for. In real life, if I asked you, you need to get to the airport. You've got a flight coming up. What time should you set your alarm? The question you would probably ask is, well, what time is my flight? And you would work backwards from the flight. Well, it's going to take me an hour to get to the airport. It's going to take me an hour to get through security. It's going to take me, I need to get up at X time. We do that with everything in our lives. It's how we get anywhere on time. It is how we accomplish anything great in our lives, is we think about what do we need to accomplish and what will it take to get there. And we generally work our way backwards. If we're going to have a big dinner party and everybody's arriving at 7 o'clock and I want to make sure dinner is ready, I work backwards. When it comes to creating social change, we do the exact opposite. We ask, what is the problem and what will we do? We don't ask, what does good look like? What does it look like if the world is equitable, if the world is just, if people are joyful, if they're healthy, if the planet is healthy? And what are the conditions that will lead to that? And so what it takes is just like going to the airport, is setting up those dominoes, asking the questions, and walking backwards. You look at that last domino. I can't stand here and yeah, if it was real dominoes, I could walk over and plunk down the last one. But in real life, I can't push that last domino. But I can create the conditions that will create the conditions that will create the conditions, because everything is interconnected and everything is cause and effect. And so if we learn to use cause and effect, just like getting to the airport, nobody says, oh, the airport, that's in the future. I don't know how to do that. Of course we know how to do that. Well, it's the same principle. And so it is just asking, if the earth is going to be healthy, what needs to be in place? Oh, okay. Well, people need to love the earth. Well, I'm picking some stuff. Hmm. People need to love the earth. People need to understand their place in the earth. Okay. What would it take for people to love the earth? What would it take for... And the more we walk backwards, what we find is that it very, very quickly becomes things we can all do. You know, people will talk about, people in our community don't trust each other. Here's a big one. People in our community don't trust each other. Okay, what would lead to trust? What would create trust? Not, reacting to their not trusting. What would trust look like? Well, people would be together. They would be in relationship with each other. Okay, what would it take for people to be in relationship with each other? Well, they'd have to know each other. Well, what would it take for people to know each other? Well, you know what? We'd need places where we can be together. What would it take to have places where we can be together? Oh, well, you know what? There's an old abandoned building. So it's not airy-fairy. It's not all of those big visions as you talk about. It's not fluffy. It's that's real. And again, that's the story we've told ourselves, is that that dream of what's possible is fluffy and airy-fairy and utopian. No, it's the only thing that's ever gotten humanity to where we are in the good stuff. It's the only thing that's ever gotten us anywhere good. And it's just figuring out, what does that take? And suddenly we went from nobody in our community trusts each other to, oh, there's an abandoned building and we could start a program. But it walks its way backwards.
Final question, Hildy. What are some of the visions that you are reverse engineering now, or that you would like to reverse engineer for creating whatever it is you want to create?
The big work that we're doing at Creating the Future right now, we're in a transitional stage. We've done proof of concept for several years, and we're at a point now to scale the impact of what we're doing so that everybody everywhere knows how to ask questions that bring out the best in each other and create the systems. We're actually going to be using collective enoughness to crowdfund a lot of that and to ask who else is doing some of the things that we need. So a bookkeeper or an assistant or an IT person or who has that capacity. So that's sort of fun. The big piece that we're going to be looking at as we expand that is twofold. One, what will it take for more and more people to know questions that they can ask? That is expanding education programs beyond, if they have to keep coming to us to learn, nobody's going to, you know, how many people could do that? But the more we can spread the education program so that it might be taught as part of college classes, it might be taught as part of resource centers. And okay, that's one thing, the sharing what we learn. The big systems change that we're starting to play with and going to be really advocating for once this scale up happens is changing the systems that actually guide social change. And so when we look at all of the systems that, whether it's nonprofits, whether it's socially conscious businesses, whether it's social enterprise, we're all asking the same questions. And the systems all go counter to the world we want to see. So we have systems that force us to compete and then yell at us for competing with each other. Yell at us that we should trust each other. Yell at us that we should work together. But you're forcing us to not work together. Looking at questions of hierarchical organizations. Just like I said, if we're the only ones teaching catalytic thinking, it's not going to change the world. Okay, what does it take to change that hierarchical, you must come to us and the board is in charge and all of those things that lead to insular thinking? So all of those systems, what does it take to have... you know, we talk about evaluation of programs in the community world, doesn't matter, social enterprise, wherever. How do you know it's working? And we talk about that as we're doing it so we can learn, which is great, but we don't share that learning. So what if the emphasis of programming was not we're feeding people so that we can feed people and we're evaluating whether we fed people? What if the whole emphasis of the program was we want to learn what it takes to build a healthy community? And towards that end, we are feeding people and sharing what we learn about feeding people with all the other people in our community that are. So the systems change we're really looking at is all of the internal systems that social change organizations of any kind work within, and that's the water we swim in. And we think we need new water.
Well, I want to excuse me. Well, I want to take this opportunity just to commend you for the work you're doing. It's quite clear Well, this is the first time we've met. It's quite clear from looking at what you've been doing that it is coming from a place of love. I don't think that's too strong a word to use. I think it's absolutely clear that that's the case. And also to commend you on because the complexity of the systems is so great and that it is can be difficult to affect that change. And sometimes it might take years or decades or generations to create the change you need to create or you want to create. That the level of patience required, I suspect, is something that would be beyond many people. So I want to commend you for that also. And before we wrap up, Hildy, how can people find out more about you, about creating the future and get involved or find out what you're up to?
Creatingthefuture.org.
Simple.
And you know, if we had another 2 hours, I could talk all about the fact that one of the systems that we have changed internally is we are as open a book as you can get. All of our board meetings, all of our strategy meetings are not only streamed online, but you are invited to be part of. You can tweet if you want to just watch them, or you, Shane, could sit in the room with us and you generally can't tell who's on our board and who's not. Oh. So anyone that wants to be part of what we're doing or just learn more, there is a ton you can be part of at creatingthefuture.org.
Thank you very much, Hildy.
Thank you.
Shane here again, really briefly before I sign off. I know that 30-minute, 45-minute, 60-minute podcast, which is what most episodes of the Life Well Lived podcast are, is a big investment of your time, and your time is your most valuable asset. So it's a huge privilege for me to have you here with me and my guests for this. So thank you so much for listening. This project, the Life Well Lived project, including this podcast and my writing on my website, is motivated by this. There is so much unhappiness, anxiety and depression in the world, and this work is about trying to make things better, tiny bit by tiny bit, one day at a time. The vision is a world where this cycle of unhappiness, anxiety and depression does not have to be handed down across multiple generations and accepted as an unavoidable fact of life. The vision is a world where everyone is liberated to know, embrace and express the full breadth of their own individual uniqueness. And the vision is a world where we can work together to solve big problems rather than squabble over minor matters out of a place of insecurity and hurt. So with all that said, let me invite you to do one of the following three things. And if you want to go ahead and do all three, please do and be a superstar listener. I'll be really grateful. Firstly, if there was something, anything that you found particularly useful in the episode you've just listened to, please let people know. Send an email. Tell someone at the bus stop, take a screenshot of this episode and post it to your favorite social media. It all helps to spread the word about this episode and the Life Well Live podcast in general. Secondly, post a review. Please go to Apple Podcasts and find this show and leave a review. And when you do, please tag me. I'm at Shane Breslin almost everywhere on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook. And thirdly and finally, if you want to make sure you don't miss any future episodes, please sign up for updates about the Life Well Lived project. Go to my website at shanebreslin.com/mission. That's shanebreslin.com/mission.